the line is the Honorable Sheila Cox. She's here to discuss her new book, Worth Fighting For, a Douglas Gibson book published by McClelland & Stewart, 3299. Welcome to the commentary.ca, the Honorable Sheila Cox. Good afternoon, Ms. Cox.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You're traveling, are you? To Kitchener, I believe, right?
I am. I'm giving a speech on the Wilfrid Laurier Lecture on Liberalism.
I see. So
at the university.
You'll be encountered, no doubt, by media people when you get there, and they'll probably ask you about Carolyn Parrish. May I ask you your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that Carolyn Parrish's situation is a symptom of something, a deeper malaise in the Liberal caucus. There's certainly a lot to be said for being a team player and being a part of a team, but you have to remember that Mr. Martin's henchmen have been working for years to encourage people to undermine the previous leader. So it's a bit like the Pandora's box is open and Parrish has jumped out.
And the other story, your book, Worth Fighting For, has been out now for a while. And you talk about the Prime Minister in the last half of the book. You write, the story that's been talked about a lot has been that of your allegation that he wanted to cancel the Canada Health Act, which he and his colleagues have roundly denied. Do you still stand by your allegation in your book?
Absolutely, and if you get a copy of the book written by the current editor of the Globe and Mail, and the current editor of Maclean's magazine, and you go to page 282, they actually say that the Canada Health Act was central to the discussion of the Canada Health and Social Transfer, and they also say that I was so concerned about the wording that I went to the Prime Minister and got it changed in the enabling legislation for the budget. Now, you saw the current governor of the Bank of Canada and also a former official in finance saying there was never any relationship between the two, but in their book they clearly make a link and say that I intervened to get the wording of the budget implementation bill changed.
Well, why do you think they're denying it then? Is it because...
Well, I mean, they're the same people who say that they didn't make a phone call to Danny Williams when clearly a phone call was made and a promise was made. They've operated for a very long time on half-truths and misinformation. And I remember quite clearly when Mr. Martin was in British Columbia, when we had the debate on the Star Wars, he said he was opposed,
right,
for example. And now clearly he's moving in a different direction. So I don't think it's the first time that they've changed positions and been uncomfortable with the published position that that they've been advocating behind the scenes.
And you've encountered difficulty with Mr. Martin and his and this regime, dating back to just after the 1984 election when you were first elected to the House, right?
Well, I wouldn't say I encountered difficulty.
I was approached
on the night of the election by somebody who turned out to be somebody working for Paul Martin to become the Prime Minister. So what people have to understand is that his team, which was working double overtime in the last few years to undermine Mr. Chrétien, has been working since at least 1984. And it's rather ironic that that they fire Carolyn Parrish for her comments about the Prime Minister when in the previous time Mr. Martin worked very hard to encourage members to come out and oppose Mr. Chrétien. So it's a little disingenuous for him to say that members shouldn't be entitled to speak out when he actually encouraged them to do so when he was waiting for Mr. Chrétien's job.
Now, in your book, you talk about the whole GST fiasco and how that was the Red Book of 1993 said that they would cancel that upon taking office when you got into...
Well, the Red Book actually didn't say that. What happened in 1993 is because the Red Book did not say it, a number of members were very upset, and we went to the Prime Minister and said, we have to include this because we've been so vocal in the opposition. So there was a statement made at that time, and it was part of the platform of the campaign, although it was not specifically published in the Red Book.
And you were trapped by Peter Mansbridge, as you write in your book?
Well, in fact, the reason I went into the whole business of the GST is because most people just remembered me promising to resign and the GST, and the point that I make in the book is that after the election, it was up to the Department of Finance to work on a replacement. I was the environment minister. So it was rather ironic that I became the lightning rod for the GST, and in Paul Martin's office they used to call Get Sheila Tax because they knew I'd made a very intemperate statement, and they were going to make sure that hung me out to dry.
And, well, so I've read reviews of your book, and it's most talked about is the fact that, you know, you are rather, I guess, I don't know how to put it, critical of the Martin campaign, or the Martin regime. Some people say that's sour grapes on your part. Do you buy that, or do you disagree? Because you were edged out.
I think most people that actually read the book, from my understanding anyway, and this goes from, I think there was a literary review published just a couple of days ago, through to the fact that it's on the bestseller list in both French and English. Most people really like the book. I think what happened was the Prime Minister's office orchestrated an attempt to discredit the book, targeting in on two or three facts that were basically discussed between myself and David Dodge. You know, for example, the facts at midnight. There's no doubt that that book is much more than my relationship with Paul Martin, but there's also no doubt that you can't write a story of your time in Parliament, and especially your time in Cabinet, without having some discussion about what happened with the Minister of Finance. He was a central part of the whole story. So when we talked, for example, about Canada Health Act, you know, a month ago, Mr. Martin signed an agreement which gave special status in health care to Alberta and Quebec. He's now, literally this week, sending off a provincial premier, Mr. Charest, to do an international trade mission with the Prime Minister of another country. So if I had concerns about the integrity of the national health care, it's not because I dream them up. It's because he will move to any sort of federalism to achieve his goals. And I think the Liberal Party is certainly going to be somewhat concerned about the fragmenting of the country.
One of the things I found interesting in your that you discuss in the book is the double standard that you supposedly suffered from being not only a Liberal opposition member but also being female.
Oh, as a woman, sure, there's a huge double standard.
That still applies to this day.
Absolutely. And I don't think it's unique to politics. I think, you know, we live in a country, I think we're 36 in the world when it comes to parliamentarians, women parliamentarians. The number one country in the world is actually Rwanda. But it's also true in the financial sector, in the business sector. It's pretty widespread overall. And politics just happens to be one of the more public places. So in that sense, you know, I call the book Worth Fighting For because I want to encourage women and minorities to get involved, because you don't change the system if you're sitting on the sidelines.
Margaret Thatcher was Prime Minister during your time in public life. Do you consider her a feminist?
No, she wasn't a feminist. She never appointed a woman to any of her cabinet positions.
I find it interesting, though, that she did make it to the top of her political structure in Britain as well as in the world. Yet,
so did Golda Meir, and so did Benazir Bhutto, and so did Indira Gandhi, and et cetera, et cetera. But she doesn't live in Canada.
What do you think it is in Canada that doesn't allow for women to get to the top, if you will?
Well, I think there's a huge glass ceiling which kicks in, and I was just literally watching last week. There was a television show on the 10 Great Canadians,
right,
and not a single one of them is a woman. And Evan Solomon was waxing eloquent about the characteristics of a leader when he was talking about Alexander Graham Bell, and he said, a leader is a man who must do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Now, this is the CBC in 2004 talking about a leader in one gender, and that's around us all the time. People see and envision leaders as being white men.
How, then, do you think you would bring more females and more minorities to public life?
Well, I think one of the things you have to do is actually have a target. And in the book, I explain how in 1993, I actually went to the Prime Minister in 1991 and I said, look, we've got a chance to form the government. Let's change the face of Parliament. And so we actually had a target of 25% women candidates. And I was given the responsibility of going across the country to recruit them. and work with provincial presidents, and in one election we doubled the number of women. You need targets. You need objectives. You need deliverables. You can't just talk about it. I mean, in the last election, Mr. Martin actually made the ridiculous statement that he was going to have 50% women candidates without anything to back it up, just to say it, and then we ended up with fewer women in Parliament and fewer women actually running for all the parties in the last election than when we formed the government in 1993.
Also in your book you talk about family, and obviously you've been lucky that you've had a supportive family. How hard has it been for them to
have... Oh, very hard. I think it's hard for any family, and I think particularly because I think women, again, are... It's funny, you know, I think one of the sort of standing jokes for women in politics is you need a wife. I have a very supportive spouse, but there's no doubt that women carry a lot more of the load of the house, and when you're doing that, plus running back and forth to Ottawa, it can be extremely challenging. So I think that's tough for women. It's certainly tough for people from the West Coast, for example. I think it's tougher to be a member of Parliament from British Columbia than one from Ontario for that very reason. It just wreaks havoc with your family life.
I was thinking of the Hustler incident, as well as even just inane quotes from, like, Fotheringham, who would say, you know, Sheila Copps looks like she hasn't been missing meals lately. I mean, how did your family deal with that kind of attention, that kind of criticism, that kind of constant in the public eye?
Well, I think
it must have been hard for them to not take it personally.
I think the hardest part was probably the last couple of years. The last year was really tough because you saw how the Martin machine came down on the book. We suffered that just about every day. They had a huge grip on the party and they had tentacles everywhere and they really went out to discredit their opponents. And that was a lot more hurtful than what you read from Alan Fotheringham. I mean, I don't really think Alan Fotheringham can give any lessons on weight. I didn't worry too much about what he said.
Right. You also talk about the bureaucracy. I guess the stereotype that there are Sir Humphrey Applebys in the civil service.
Absolutely. But you know what? I don't think it's so much... I think the bureaucracy is kind of reflecting the reality of the world in 2004. The system keeps marching on, regardless of who's running it. And I think there are some challenges for national governments in how to figure out how you're relevant in the lives of people. Because bureaucrats do stay while politicians come and go, and oftentimes you get the feeling that unless you're really, really strong, it's hard to literally get the bureaucracy to follow you and your agenda.
You're still a member.
Very strong.
You're still a member of the Liberal Party, are you not?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you live in Hamilton East Stoney Creek?
No, I live in Ottawa. I have a house in Hamilton East Stoney Creek, and I have an office also, but I actually have a house in Ottawa, too.
I see. In your book, you write about Earnscliffe and the incestuous relationship between its principals like David Hurley and Ellie Albom, as well as Lansdowne Technologies, this company that's partly owned by the Prime Minister, and which also got untendered government contracts when he was Minister of Finance. Why do you think we're not hearing about stuff like this in the mainstream media?
I don't know. I mean, it's amazing to me. I mean, I pointed out in the book that the media was far more interested in my assistant's $14 lunches than they were in the fact that Mr. Martin got $160 million in business support for his companies. And ironically, the $160 million that he got was reported by Ralph Goodale as $134,000, and then they said it was, quote, a clerical error. So it's, I don't know. I mean, that's a question I've kind of been scratching my head and asking myself, and perhaps that's something that the media should be asking.
The beginning of the book, March 6, 2004, you write that as the date that marked a turning point in my lifelong devotion to the Liberal Party of Canada. Where is Sheila Copps today? Are you going to run again, or do you support this party, this government?
Oh, I won't be running under Paul Martin, no. No. I certainly support the Liberal Party, but I think the party is, leaders come and go, and the party is, in fact, tonight I'm speaking at the Laurier chair for Wilfrid Laurier University, parties are much deeper than one leader.
And did you ever, did you rule out running again for the leadership?
I don't rule out running for leadership, no. No, I don't rule anything out, but I certainly won't be running under Mr. Martin.
You spent 20 years in Ottawa, and you know, you can point to legislation, you can point to the famous five statute on Parliament Hill, but I guess at the end of the day, it's that email from, I'm going to butcher the name, that you write about in the book, Cyrosi Aksha? Is that the name of the young lady that sent you an email?
Oh, yes, 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 uh-huh.
How do you explain that to people that have certain cynicism towards politicians when someone like this writes you an email and says that they admire you? Well, talk about the email.
I think the reason I put the email in is because it was sort of like there was a bit of a disconnect between official Ottawa and ordinary people, and obviously as I'm out of politics, I'm seeing it even more so. But I think a lot of young people, and especially young women, it's amazing the number of young women that have come out to actually buy the book. It's just been absolutely amazing. So I think that piece, I'd like to think that politics is worth fighting for because the young women need to be inspired. And they need to make a career choice themselves to get into politics. It's amazing that, you know, Margaret Thatcher, when she left the United Kingdom, how many years ago was that? And in North America, we have no, certainly in Canada, we have no immediate prospect of having a woman run our country, even though, you know, we've alternated between the French and the English for how many years, and here we've never thought about having a woman.
Another story that's in the news today is that of your former colleague, Alfonso Galliano. I mentioned this because in your book, Tony Valeri introduced you to an acquaintance that he had who was in waste management in New Jersey, a gentleman by the name of Frank Battaglia.
Right, right.
What do you make of the Galliano story today? Is there any...
I don't know what to make of it. Somebody just spoke to me about it, but I haven't read it, and I wouldn't comment because I don't know enough about it.
Sheila Copps,